Okay, please help me welcome Jordan from my cheat sheet from the South College Speakers Group in Delaware.
All right, my name's Jordan. I'm an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date of February 25th, 2007. I've been through the steps. I have a sponsor, and I also sponsor others. It's been a while since I've had to do this, so bear with me. I might jump all over the place. I'm going to do the best I can to kind of show you what this this program has done for me. I grew up in a house full of love. My father and mother met in AA. My grandparents are in the program. My uncle's in the program, actually, who I live with, has 10 years sober. Basically, my butt was destined for one of these chairs the day I was brought into this world. My grandmother used to call me a bear in hibernation, just waiting for the day that I'd come out and really start a rampage throughout everything. I'll start out with my mother passed away when I was 2.5 years old to this disease. She was doing whippets behind the wheel, and she killed herself. She had 2.5 years sober. Basically she was actually the same age as I am now when all this happened. And I actually have 3 years. So you can imagine my father freaking out, right around the last couple months. From the beginning, I always had like this identity crisis, and I also used my mother's death as power and also for attention. I always had to be the center of attention. I always also liked to do anything that took me out of myself when I was younger. I'd be the kid that was throwing firecrackers. My stepmother came downstairs and found me with two Lysol cans in my hand over candles, like blow torches. Anything I could do. I was also the kid that was in class that the teachers would give special privileges to, such as give me clay, Play-Doh, whatever they could to just keep me quiet for a little while, because that's just who I was. I was very outgoing from the get-go, but I also, I was suffering from spiritual malady and just didn't know it at the time. And that's where that barren hibernation comes, Now that I have a pretty decent amount of time in this program, I totally get it. You know, all my character defects that I've had have been through the span of my life, and I can see that now. And it just took a heck of a long time to get there. But my whole entire life revolved around sports, because that was another outlet for me and another way for my dad to keep me quiet and relax. And, I did everything under the sun, karate, soccer, lacrosse, wrestling, swimming, everything, anything to get myself out of my own freaking head. Because I was always just this insecure little kid walking around this planet. As simple as, a bunch of kids walking down the boardwalk, they'd be three in a line. I'd be a kid in the back, and I'd be wondering why am I not? And I used to try to weasel my way up so it would be four across the line, but somehow I'd always fall back. And I know that sounds stupid, but that to me, I used to read into that and analyze it and literally go crazy about it. And, I was always consumed with the thought of death. I used to cry myself asleep. Because my mother passing away, I was always so scared to die. I was scared, and fear ruled my life, And I go through my entire life based, driven in fear. My great grand sponsor, which probably sponsors half this room, always told me there's two driving forces in this life, love and fear. You can choose which one to live in, and I was living in fear until I came into this program. I go through middle school, I go through high school, everything's pretty cool, nothing over the top. Middle school was a huge transition for me. I've been through 5 different schools in my lifetime. Like, I think 3 of them asked me not to come back, just because I used to do stupid stuff for attention, I went to high school, and I was very driven in sports. Soccer was kind of like my thing. And I wanted that soccer scholarship. I used to have one carrot in front of me, and I would just go with it until I got it, and then I'd be like, okay, I need something else, I need something else, I need something else, I need something else. That's just how it always worked. And so basically through high school, I wanted to get that soccer scholarship, you know. And so basically that's what I did. I worked my butt off, and I got a partial soccer scholarship. And as soon as I knew where I was going to school and I knew I was in, that's when the fun, I thought, could start to begin. And it wasn't actually to my junior year in high school that I really started, I started messing around with drinking. Part of it was that fear again, because I knew my father, and I knew, you know, he's got like 27 years sober. So I was really scared to kind of mess around with it, until I realized what it could do for me. You know, that sense of ease and comfort. You know, I could close my eyes at night and not really think too much. And it took me out of myself, just like all these stealing stuff, all this other crap used to do for me. And, you know, it worked. But, again, I was too fearful to let it take away my soccer scholarship, because I heard it could take away, you know, if they catch you drinking or age, blah, 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 blah. And so I was freaking out about that. So I was on and off most of my junior year. And then my senior year, I was getting drunk and high before school all the time. I thought it was cool to walk down the hallways and being on a diagonal. Oops. And, you know, because, you know, that's what I thought was cool. I had me and two other buddies that used to do it all the time. And basically then summer came around and I got that new carrot in front of my head. I wanted to be the only freshman soccer starter on this Northeastern University up in Boston, which is a Division I school in the Colonial Athletic League. It would be a big deal if I could be the starter and be, once again, the center of attention, because that's what I wanted to be. And I get up to Boston, and my mindset is not on school at all, any way, shape, or form. You know, in high school, no one ever called me to hang out. In high school, nobody ever wanted to hang out. I was a kid that I'd call everyone else, and they'd be like, oh, we'll call you back later. And nobody wanted me around. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to go to college with a different mindset. I'm going to be the one you call for a party. I'm going to be the one you call for drugs. I'm going to be the one. I'm going to be the cool kid. I'm going to be popular for once. And that's what I thought this hole in my soul was about, was that if I was popular and I did these things, that you would like me and accept me. Not because I was not comfortable in my own skin. I thought you needed these things to be popular and to be accepted and to be loved most of all. And so I do that. And, you know, I get the cute girlfriend. I get to be the only freshman starter. I'm the kid. I got all those things. I got them. Why do I still want to kill myself? And that was the question running through my head. And I'm like, And the drink, that's when it kind of started turning on me. You know, I can still remember my first blackout. It was the day before Thanksgiving break, 2006, 2005. I woke up with a cheesesteak on my chest and a beer spilled on the ground. And I came to and I was like, whoa, I got to make my plane. Didn't think anything of it, you know, because that's what I thought drinkers, like good drinkers do, is blackout. Because that's what I was told, I guess. I don't know where I got that from. But, you know, that's what I thought mattered. And that's the only thing I wanted, was to be popular, accepted, loved. And, you know, that's it. And I did everything I could possibly do to search for it. And I never got it. And I was wondering why. I got all this stuff I was telling you, you know, the soccer scholar, I got all that crap, I got the popularity, all the stuff that I thought you needed, and I come home for Christmas break, and that's when my alcoholism really started kicking in. I started drinking by myself, you know, all those wonderful, you know, drunk monologues, whatever you want to call them, and basically, I go to my neighbor's house, I drink a fifth of Sky vodka to myself. I come home, I fall down the steps, put my head through the drywall, my dad finds me there in the morning. And, you know, my dad being in recovery, all sorts of stuff, bells started ringing in his head. So my dad goes to work, I finally wake up, completely have no idea, go to my mom, hey mom, how you doing? And she goes, you don't remember a thing, do you? I was like, no, I don't, what happened? She, basically she was like, you need to be ready by 11:30, because your dad's taking you somewhere. I was like, oh, all right, sweet. 18 years old, I got drugged to a 12 o'clock meeting, all those uncles, Pop Paul, Paul Lockery, all these people that I thought were literally related to me, they were all just my father's friend in the program, And they all decided to show up for Jordan's first meeting. And I was like, awesome, this really sucks. I'm still hungover. They're handing me 24-hour-a-day coins. They're handing me big books. Everyone is literally turning around and being like, Jordan, we're so happy you finally made it. And then I'm like sitting here like, dude, shut up. Like, you're like, ugh. Like, you know, you're freaking me out. I just found out you're really not related to me. And now you're like turning around and telling me all this stuff. And my head was between my legs. I was so full of fear. But I was so good at pulling out those masks and putting them up towards everybody. Because that's what I did my whole entire life. I knew how to manipulate. I knew how to con. I knew whatever you wanted to hear. I'm a schmoozer. I am. You know, that's why I'm such a good freaking waiter. Anyways, that's coming later in the story. So basically, I'm like, all right. So my dad gives me, you know, I always made up these contracts with my father and my stepmother. That, like, you know, I would sign it, they would sign it, like, you like, and all this bull that I never came step followed through with, and they kept falling for it. But anyways, so I kept doing it. So I, in order to go back up to Boston and do what I want to do, I have to go to meetings for the next week and a half to go back up to school. Because my dad was going to pull me out, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, no, you can't do it. My life will end. I have friends up there, blah, blah. And I'm like, and he was like, all right, well, then here's, like, you know, those, I don't know the word I'm searching for, but your ultimatum or whatever it was. So I did it. You know, I went to those meetings, and I knew that I would see people in those meetings that would obviously talk to my father. So I would, like, talk, and I'd speak, and be like, dude, I'm so happy I'm here, da-da-da-da, and I would just completely BS it, because that's what I was good at. But the thing is that I'll never forget it, and I still see this guy all the time now. His name's Rob, and he was sitting next to me, and it was, like, my second or third meeting, and he comes in there, and he's like, you know what? I want to put a bullet in my head. I hate life, and I don't know what to do. And I'm so sick and tired of living the way I'm living. Someone needs to help me. And I, like, looked at him being 18 years old, and I, like, scooted over on the couch a little bit. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, you know, because I didn't have that desperation yet. I drank the way you drank. I knew that. But, you know, no one talked about the emotional side of Alcoholics Anonymous until I came back after another 3 years of drinking. I never heard being full of fear. I never heard about a racing head. I didn't hear about anything like that. And I heard about all those, you know, those drunk logs. I lost my wife. I lost my kids. I'm like, dude, I'm 18 years old. I haven't lost any of that. So obviously I must not be an alcoholic, you know. So I was like, all right, you know, they were talking about blackouts and stuff like that. Or, you know, don't get me wrong. Maybe my ego just ran wild and I never heard any of it. But I'm pretty sure the memes around me. You know, that's what I heard an alcoholic was. You know, some hobo on the side of the street asking for change with a brown paper bag in his hand. And I was like, that's not me, you know. Like, I come from a family that has, you know, decent amount of money, all that, and I'm not that. So I pulled out all those masks, and I got to go back up to Northeastern University up in Boston. I did pretty good, actually. I had 2 months sober. I didn't go to a meeting like I told my father I would. As I signed that contract, I would go up there and find a sponsor, and lo and behold, my sponsor now is up in Boston. I went up there and I did my 19th birthday came along, and 2 months being without my solution in my life, I was like, all right, you know what? I'm going to go out, have a good time for my 19th birthday. Bang. Whole entire thing started, and my life took a turn like it's never taken before. I started drinking every day. Started drinking before school, after school, during school, lost the soccer scholarship, lost the girl. Pretty much was everything that you could possibly lose as a 19-year-old that you've earned, which, you know, might not be that much, but in my life it was circumstantial. It was huge. It's just at that point I started to feel that desperation. And I came home to mommy and daddy, and I do what I do best. I run them into the ground until I get a little bit better about myself, get a few bucks in my pocket, and then I go and take it off again. So I came home after summer, after failing every class, pretty much throwing $17,000 out the window, and full of regret, full of guilt, full of all this bull crap. And I start working for my father. He owns his own landscaping businesses, and he owns a floral nursery selling flowers. And I hate that job, man. August, when he comes in, man, all he does is water flowers. And it's the only thing you can think about is being in your head, which is not the place I ever wanted to be. And so 2 months go by again in the summer, and I started thinking it's a good idea again to go down to University of Delaware, where my home group is now. And so I think that's a good idea to start going down there and hanging out with some of my old high school friends that I got drunk with in high school, which, you know, to me at the time was like, oh, cool, you know, rekindle some flames with some friends and blah, blah. And basically I, again, was running my life into the ground. And you know what? At the time, I was pissed at my father for what he did, but now that I look at it, it was the best thing he's ever done for me. He took away my cell phone, he took away my keys, he took away the car because I was going through Burger King, the drive-thru, and, you know, those big yellow cement pylons, I kind of just went all down the side of his brand-new truck that he bought me, and, you know, I still ordered, and I still went through the thing, and I came home. I parked the car in a weird position, and I had paint thinner, which isn't the brightest idea, because I thought I could hide it. And, yeah, he came in at, like, 7:30, threw an at-home drug test at me. I failed miserably, obviously. I took away my keys, took away my cell phone, took away everything that, you know, and, you know, I thought he was kicking me out of the house. You know, that's what I thought. Because, like, and he wasn't. He just was really ticked off. And that's what I used. That's what I ran with for the next year. My father kicked me out of my house, and everyone should feel bad for me, and you know, because that's what I do. So more or less, I start the journey. I actually stole my mother's credit card, stole $200 out of her purse, which I've never done before, and I started doing those things too. And I thought the girl, like, I could go get the ex-girlfriend back, which I did, because I'm good at, you know, manipulating people. And so I go up there, and I live with her in her dorm. Which was with five other women who absolutely despise me. That's an experience living with five women. Anyways, I learned quite a few things. So I went up there and I start running through her life the way I was running through my parents, and it started, the snowball effect comes. And you know, I finally got a job waiting tables, and I'm starting to make $900 to $1,200 a week working like 4 days. Oh my God, hallelujah! You know, it's like it was like a miracle, and I'm making great money. You know, and every night afterwards, I started finding myself in a bar because I got a fake ID. and I just kept doing that night in, night out, going home at 4 o'clock in the morning. Sleeping until 4 o'clock the next day to wake up for my shift at 5. Didn't pay attention to anybody but myself and what was going on in my head. All those regrets, all those fears, everything that was wrong with Jordan. And didn't care about anybody else. So finally that ex-girlfriend, who was my girlfriend at the time, worked up enough courage to say, get out of my life. And, you know, I was like, no, you can't do it. You know, trying to, you know, manipulate her one more time. And she stuck to her guns. And thank God she did. Because I don't think I'd be here if she didn't do that. So then I'm like all by myself, you know, and that's the worst place because once again, I have to be stuck in my own freaking mind with no solution but drugs and alcohol. So I continue, you know, and waiting tables for about another month and a half, and I'm thinking it's a brilliant idea, it's just funny to me, like the things that I would do to people in the places and to get what I wanted, you know? And I'm not going to go into detail about stuff like that, but, you know, because we all got our stories. And at my job, you know, they did nothing but try and help me, and I never saw it. You know, I still talk to my old manager to this day, you know, and I made amends to him, but that's a little later, and I'll get into that. But it's just amazing, like, all the stuff that was around me that I never saw. You know, I went to an all-boy Catholic school, you know, but, you know, there's a guy back there knows what I'm talking about. It was like the patron saint of humility, and that's the first thing I learned in this program. Like, it was just, everything was around me. I just was too blind on myself and everything that was going on with me to even see it. And so more or less, I lost the job. I lost the money. I was getting into stuff I said that I would never do, all those yets. And that desperation really started to kick in. So it is my father's birthday, and I'm going to decide to be a great son and come home and surprise him, you know, because I'm such a good, kind-hearted son. More or less, I had no more money left. I was getting kicked out of my house. I didn't have any money for the things I needed. I was falling asleep on park benches. Just the times that I fell asleep in Boston where there was blizzard out, and I couldn't even get my key into my own door to unlock it. And I fell asleep out there, and my landlord would find me at 6 o'clock in the morning on his way to work. And he was like, dude, what are you doing? And I was my keys in the thing, and he would open it for me, and I'd go in and stumble down to my room, which was in a basement. All I had was a futon, like mattress on the ground, bunch of pizza boxes, 2-liter bottles, all my other good stuff laying right next to me. So I'd never had to deal with reality. I never had to, you know, deal with life because I didn't know how to. Because my whole entire life I've been running from it and filling it with other stuff. And it came to a point where, you know, I was going to be a kind-hearted son and come home and surprise my father. I turn off my cell phone. I close the laptop computer. I tell my roommate who I'm living with at the time to put all of his booze in his room and lock it. And I'm like, I'm going to stay sober. I'm going to make this plane trip tomorrow. Hallelujah. We can do this. All right. And lo and behold, 2 hours pass by, and I'm on my way to a party because that's what I do. And I blacked out, as I usually always did when I drank. And I woke up in a holding cell in the Southie. It was just called – it's called Southie, which it's just like the bad Irish project, like I ghetto, I guess, in Boston. And I was oh, man. Anyways, so I was drunk, and I decided that I was going to break into an apartment, and I broke into this apartment, climbed through the screen window, I attacked these three girls with a broom, because I'm a gangster, and I started chasing them out with the broom and telling them I'm going to kill them, and like I think they were just freaked out because of how messed up I was that they just ran out of the building. Apparently what I did was I used their microwave pockets. I used their Stouffer's mac and cheese, passed out drunk in the same apartment complex, that I broke into, passed out with all their frozen food products in my jacket, passed out with their Stouffer's mac and cheese in my lap. And the cops woke up, like found me there and like woke me up. And, God's got a weird way, really weird way of answering prayers. Anyways, So I got a felony breaking and entering on me, terroristic threats on these girls, and terroristic threats on an officer. Because I guess I was, you know, that gangster came out on me again. I told him I was gonna mess him up with my broom. real quick story on the like a side note. All my friends when I first got sober used to buy me Hot Pockets and Stouffer's mac and cheese like it was their job, and they thought it was really really funny. And I got really really pissed. I'm like, dude, seriously, it's old, but they thought it was really funny. Anyways, back to the story. So I woke up in this holding cell, and the only thing I remember is this guy's name was Sajid McCarthy, and he was this big Irish dude, and he was like, he was jacked, like Marines, like crazy hair, like that really like Marine haircut, and he jacked me up against this wall, and he told me, you better get your life straight, son, or you're going to have even more bigger issues at hand. And it took me a while to sober up. To like work the holding cell phone, you have to hold in the red button and then dial and hold it the whole entire time in case anyone was not wondering. So I finally sobered up enough to use the phone. And I called my father, collect, and he's already 2.5 hours in his drive up to Boston on the New Jersey Turnpike because he got a message at I think like 4 o'clock in the morning saying there's a situation with your son. We need to speak to you immediately. He thought I was dead. He thought he was coming up to ID his son on a slab. And he found out that I was alive, and I think he wanted to kill me anyways. but he turned around. I got out. My friend actually came and posted bail because he wanted to make sure, like, that he could get his fix of what I had. Go figure. So, dude, I'll bail you out if, you know, we'll call it even. If you, I'm like, all right, that works. anyways. So I get out in time, I make my plane, and I'm on that plane ride home, still drunk, still high. And I get off the plane, and there's my father. And there's a different bond between me and my father because we were it was just me and him for 5 years. And there's it's a weird relationship. But I've never seen that man cry, ever. And it was the first time I've ever seen that man shed a tear. And he held me and never let go. And for my father, if you knew my father, that's a big deal. It's a huge deal. And something clicked. That dude, I need to change my life. And something's got to give here. And, you know, then I got to come home. And, you know, the next morning, it is, I think, 48 hours without sleep. Because I was detoxing on something else. And I'm sneaking out of my house to go to my neighbor's wine cellar, which was like awesome because they never locked it. And it was like my thing, the place to go. And my neighbors don't know what to do with all the money they have, so they just build random things, like wine cellars. So I was on my way there, and my dad was at, it was like 5:30 in the morning, which I never knew my dad got up that early. And he was actually up doing his meditation for the day. And he looked at me, he's like, "Son, where are you going?" And I looked at him, it was the first time I ever been honest. And whether or not I know it, it was the first time I actually kind of gave up my will. And I told him, I was like, "Dad, I need to go get drunk. I don't care. I need something to turn off my mind." And this is my exact words. And he goes, "Son, why don't you try rehab?" And all these red flags went up. I was like, "Oh, wait a minute. I'm better than that." You know, like, come on, let's be serious. Like, I don't need rehab. I'll go to those classes, those meeting things again. And he was like, he looked at me and he was like, "Jordan, you know, this is a perfect time in your life. You don't have kids. You don't have a wife. You obviously don't have school. You don't have soccer. You don't, you know." And I was just like, "Yeah, that's a good point. True. All right. Sweet." Once again, I was pulling those masks out with my back pocket to make my father happy, make my stepmother happy, and get what I wanted and get to where I wanted. So I was like, all right, I can sacrifice a month of my time to just, you know, get a little better and go out and have some fun, you know, because that's what I've been good at my whole entire life again. And so I go to Bowling Green, lo and behold, which is 2.5 miles away from my house. Terrible idea why they sent me there in the first place. I go there, and it's about a year. It's about 4 days, and I'm like ready to go AOA, and because I'm that gangster, I'm like peace. And because I didn't want to, because guess what? I didn't have my solution, and I am going literally crazy in my head. This guy Rob popped back in my head about him wanting to put a bullet in his head. I was too much of a coward to ever try and take my own life, but I had mental pictures like it was nobody's job of how I would do it, where I would do it, what I would do, because, you know, I was so self-consumed. And that's how I felt on the inside. And so basically, I go to rehab. They're like, "You're way too close to home. We're going to send you to Sellersville, the Penn Foundation." I'm like, whoa, where's that? And it's about 2 hours away, sir. I'm like, "Oh, no, I'm not doing it." Once again, my dad gives me the spiel. "You don't have a wife, you don't have school, blah, 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 blah. Just try it, please, for us." I'm like, all right. So I go there, and, I think probably the core of this home group, I don't know if I see anybody out there, but, Scotty, Jack, Chris, M, Greg, all these guys kept coming and showing up at Penn Foundation. And they were talking about a solution that worked, and they were smiling, laughing. I'm like, "Dude, I hate you. You know, can't you see me in the back row, like, miserable? Hello, I'm right here, this guy, come ask me how I'm doing." Because I was selfish and self-centered, and the world revolved around me. I finally got up the courage after one of the meetings, and it was like asking it was like asking Greg H. out on a date, which he probably would have liked. I was rocking back and forth, and I felt like I was asking out, like, it was like a prom date for me, because I had to swallow my pride for 2 seconds and say, "Dude, I need help." And that was a sign of weakness, because I was supposed to be a manly man, you know. And I had to ask another human being to show me how to live. And that was the hardest thing I've ever had to do, ever, you know, and because, you know, I saw my father's whole life, and he's like this tough 6'1" Irish dude that never asked a stinking thing, and that's what I thought I had to do. And lo and behold, I started going through the steps, and I started off. And, you know, the first thing I said, I was, you know, he described humility, which is an accurate assessment of who and what we really are, coupled with a sincere desire to change and become what we can be. And that I was going to need that on throughout this journey, especially in the beginning. And I said, all right. And, you know, he's like, are you willing to go to any lengths? And I said, no, but I'll try. No, I said yes. But in my head, that's what I said. You know, he asked me, you know, to read the doctor's opinion. We agnostic. So I read it and think I got like some, you know, I'm getting like a degree in this. And I'm like, oh, I know exactly what's going on. Exactly. And no idea. And, you know, I finally would just shut up. And he told me the only things he wanted to hear out of my mouth from now on was, I don't know. I was like, but he was like, no, just tell me you don't know. I was like, I don't know. It was like, dude, it like stung to say it because I always had an answer for everything because I was so good at spinning things to make it work for me. And to swallow that pride was the hardest thing I think I've ever done, tell another man that I don't know something. And it hurt, you know, but it was also the process of this whole entire program. And so I went along and I go through the steps and he tells me drugs and alcohol are my problem. I'm like, oh, thank you. And he said they were the solution to every single one of my problems, and every single one of my problems was of my own making, based out of self-centered fear. And he was like, just bear with me. And I was like, drug and alcohol. And then, you know, I got to that fourth step, and he said liquor was but a symptom. I have a spiritual malady, a spiritual disconnect within me that, you know, I've been trying to fill with everything between drugs, women, beer, whatever it was, stealing stuff, adrenaline rushes. You know, I thought I could be like Sean White. You know, that was a bad idea. I got a concussion. But anyways, anything that could take me out of myself, I used to do. And he said that this program could offer me a way of life that, you know, could stop the racing head, that could stop the fear, that could, you know, I could feel things, and I could be somebody that people could trust, that they could rely on, that they could. And I'm like, yeah, okay, sure, sounds good. So I took a step and I did it and I tried it, and I'm here 3 years later, you know, speaking at a meeting, one of the meetings that I love to used to come to, and that's one of the absolute beauties of this program. It comes back tenfold. I was told don't put time on God, because when you do, you know, that's your mind, you know, trying to play something that you don't understand. And so I didn't. And I used to hear all these really cool stories about people and how they found God. And I hated God. Didn't want anything to do with him. You know, he took my mother away. He took my grandmother away. He took all these things. And, you know, I wanted nothing to do with it. And, you know, he just said, you know, though, probably heard, most of you who have sponsored, been through the steps, have heard this line, you know, do you see God working in my life? You know, God, I wanted to say no, but you know what? I did. I saw it working in so many people's lives in this program, and I wanted what you had, so I finally shut up and did what you were doing. And I stepped over that dark abyss they talk about, you know, to those desired shores of faith. And I started to work this program like no other. I used to be a greeter. I used to make coffee. I used to go to detoxes. I was doing all these things. I filled my car up with as many people. You know, I had a choice of getting the truck I have now, or a minivan. And it was simply said by my sponsor. He goes, how many can you fit in the Toyota? I said, 5. How many can fit in the minivan? 7. I'll let you make the decision on which one to take. Minivan. Awesome. Ford Windstar. It's pretty sweet. I had one of those TVs. I thought it was, it was terrible. Talk about, you know, swallowing that ego and that image that I was so consumed with, you know, having all those things on the outside to match the insides, because I didn't want you to know what was going on in here, and especially not freaking in here, you know, because if you knew, you'd definitely think I was crazy. I can't tell you how much I love this program and the people in it, and, you know, one of the best things I've been able to do is give back, you know, and watch, you know, God use me as a vessel for his message. And only that, and have me be that vessel to reach into someone else's heart and flick on that God switch and see that sparkle come on in their eyes. It's one of the most beautiful things you could possibly imagine. And it's one of those things where you just step back and you I've never been so grateful and full of gratitude in my entire life. It was pretty powerful stuff. But I got that through taking these 12 steps. And I got my God moment. I got it. And I've never laughed, cried in my life. Like, it was just this back and forth, like, and I've never had this sense of ease and comfort come over me in my entire life. I was about 5 months sober, and I was hurting. I was definitely hurting. I moved back home. I moved away from the comfort zone of this area and the people I made friends with through rehab, and I was on my own again. And I was trying to make new relationships and trying to just go out and be a sponsor, go out and do commitments. I was working for my dad again, which is so tough, man, because we are the same person, and all we do is this. And since I stopped working with him, our relationship's a lot better. But it was hard for me to keep, like, just know my dad's doing the best he can with what he has, and I need to respect him and just show up and be a son. That's it. That's my living amends to my father. And so I was doing some other stuff outside of AA to kind of increase my spirituality. And I went to a church, and I went up and I talked to a pastor that was there. And basically he was in recovery too, so it was really cool. And he still was in this program, and he was also a pastor. And, you know, so he knew exactly where I was coming from, and I kind of told him a little bit about myself, and I told him about my mother passing away. And, of course, he was like, he prayed, and then he also said, real quick, son, what was your mother's name? And I probably can count on my hands how many times I've literally said my mother's name. It was probably like 5 times, and I looked at him, and I said, her name's Lisa Eckert. And he touched my heart, and he asked God to come down and give me a sign with my mother within the next week to give me some closure. And I, like, red flags went off. My pride came right back in. So I was like, dude, I don't need a sign from God, okay? You know, I know he's there. So I was told not to put time on God. And, like, you know, all these red flags came. And my sponsee at the time, Ricky, was with me. And where my mother's buried was on the way to his work, which I was dropping him off at. And so I pull into the cemetery. And I can tell you the last time I was there was when I was 11 years old and I was about to go to England. And I was scared to get on the plane, so my dad took me there. And that was the last time. And now I'm 20 and a half years old, and that's my next time back to my mother's grave. And I did there, and I stood there, and I made amends to my mother. Another funny thing that happened right there and then is that my buddy's grandfather died that day. Like, it was his 1-year anniversary. And we pulled in there, and he's like, dude, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm going to say hi to my mom. He's like, and he just starts bawling. His grandfather was buried, like, a couple plots down. And it was a year to that day that his grandfather died, and he was bawling his eyes out, so that was pretty cool. And I went and made amends to my mother at her gravesite, saying that I was no different, and that I was sorry for cursing her name at night, and that, you know, she didn't have to come down and give me a sign, that I know she's always going to be watching over me. And I've never had a sense of, like, a smile on my face, and, you know, those 9-step promises were starting to come true in my life. And I get in my car, I take my buddy to work, as he's still bawling, and I go home, and I have 2 younger brothers and a younger sister and a stepmother who weren't in the house, which is a miracle in itself. And it was just me and my father. And my dad calls me up. I'm going to bed, and my dad's like, hey, real before you go to bed, I got something for you in the attic. I'm like, attic? All right. So he decided to clean out the attic that day, and he hands me a box, and he says, son, this is something that's been helping me stay sober for these past 26 years at the time. And I've been waiting a time in your life that I knew you could use these things to stay sober yourself, because I've always seen it in you. You know, I'm just waiting for you to get your own experience in this program, and I'm proud of you. That was the first time my father's ever spoken that way to me and also told me he's proud of me. So that in itself was amazing. And so he hands me this box. I'm like a little kid at Christmas. I run in my room. I open it up. I'm like, damn, it's like, what is this? Like, a bunch of old tapes, How to Be a Dad, Volume 2, and, like, all this stuff. And, you know, to the left are these flower journals, and they were my mom's diaries from 1983 to 1989. I got to know my mother overnight, who she was, where she came from, what she went through, what she was going through, what she was going to name me if I was a girl, which was weird. My name was going to be Brooke. I was either going to be in my name for Jordan, and how she felt about me, and how she cared for me, how she loved me, and it was amazing. And I don't care what you tell me. There's no ifs, ands, or buts that there's something bigger than myself out there. And that was my sign for the first time. That's when I was telling you, I was laughing, I was crying, I was laughing, I was crying. I was laughing because I was like, oh my God. And I was crying, oh my God. Like, you know, like, it was just like this overwhelming feeling. And I have had so many experiences like that. It's amazing. I went up to Boston for the accident recovery, and that's where I like kind of like ran all my rampages, and I had quite a few things to clean up there. So I went up there, and I went to that employer that I was talking to before, and I walked back there, and I handed him about $150 for all the alcohol that I could remember I stole, plus a few extra. And I told him exactly what I was doing with my life, and he looked at me, and he goes, Jordan, dude, I saw it. I just didn't know how to help you. And he goes, I'm so happy for you. And I still talk to that man now, today. He knows my sobriety date, and he remembers it. And he sends me, like, through Facebook, like, congratulations again. And it's amazing that, you know, someone remembers me. And I gave him that $150, and he said, dude, what am I supposed to do with this? I was like, it's yours to do with whatever you want. He walked to the front counter, and he put it in a tin that they were having a fundraiser for, and they put it in there. And that was awesome. It was a beautiful thing. And I made amends to that ex-girlfriend. What an experience. Oh, man. So I finally get to pick a place and time to do this. And I walk into Starbucks. She's there already. I'm like, I pit my stomach. You know, I like turned around and walked back out. And she's like, what the heck's he doing? I called my sponsor, Greg. And I'm like, dude, I don't know if I can do this. And he goes, Jordan, if you didn't have a pit in your stomach and you didn't feel uncomfortable, then you probably don't need to make an amends. I was like, shoot. I hate you. He goes, have fun. Click. So thoroughly upset. So I walk back in there, and and she goes, we order our drinks, and we sit down. She goes, I'm ready for my apology now. Oh, so that's sweet. And so I, but, you know, so we kind of laughed that off, and I was like, you're right, you're right. swallow the pride. And I told her what I was doing with my life today and how long I had sober. And she was shocked. She was very shocked. And she goes, I guess people can change. I never thought you would. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool, you know. And then she was like, what else did you do to me? I was like, you know, let's just keep it, you know, within... I'm sorry, okay? And I didn't say I'm sorry, but I told her what I was doing. And which was awesome. And then her best friend, who I despise because she was the reason we broke up, if she would have kept her mouth shut, everything would have been fine. You know, and I had to make amends to her, too. And that was all because I bawled like a little baby on my fifth step and realized that, you know, I was stepping on everyone's toes, you know, and, you know, while I was judging the world by my intentions, everyone else was judging me by my actions. And I love that. I think it's like 4:18. And that's always struck home with me about acceptance. Basically, you know, I've tried calling her. I've seen her walking. Like, she didn't want anything to do with me. And I was like, all right, well, I'm just going to keep praying and being willing. So I'm with my sponsee, Ricky, still at the same time. And we're at Sean H's house up in Boston. He's a great dude. Which is in Quincy, Mass., which is about 15, 20 minutes outside of Boston. And so I get a phone call at like 3 o'clock in the morning after I just gave the full tour of Boston to my buddy. I'm exhausted. And it's that ex-girlfriend calling me. And there was an issue with her and her medication and her drinking that night. And I was like, what? You're calling me? She goes, I need help. No one's in the house. And I was like, you're calling me? Because? Like, she goes, I know you know what you're doing. And, you know, I've seen a change. And, like, she was basically she tried Amy in, and she was drinking, and she stayed up, and she was, you know, whatever. So someone knows what's going on. So basically, I got to make a living amends to that girl. I got to show up, help her until her best friend got home. And her best friend got home. And God saw fit that I got to make that amends. And, dude, I had no idea it was coming. She came in on a rampage. Who's here? I was like, look, I just came here to help. You're here. I know she's in good hands. I'm going to hand her off to you, and I'm going to have a good night. But can I get 15 minutes of your time before? I think she's like 15 seconds. She was like, all right. It's women. And I took her down and we had a talk. And I told her what was going on and what I was doing in this program. And I caused her pain, and I can completely understand why she would never want to talk to me again. And she kind of took a step back, and she told me, she was like, I'm happy for you. If you're ever in Boston and need a place to stay, you have a place to stay. And, dude, I broke down. She goes, you know, you can't love anybody else until you love yourself. And I think you're starting to understand that, Jordan. And, I'm sure she's proud of you, and I am too. She gave me a huge hug. I went out to the car. I hit my knees, and I was one of those moments again where I was like, wow, that's awesome. That is awesome. And, you know, I can't stress enough, you know, the power of this program. You know, if you just take that leap of faith, swallow that pride, like I knew it was hard for me, and I did it, and it was amazing. And I have so many beautiful gifts to this day. You know, I have a girlfriend who loves me today for who I am, even though I can totally lose it and be crazy in my mind. You know, I have a wonderful family and a relationship. My little sister was actually, she was rushed to the hospital, actually medevaced the other day to AI DuPont Children's Hospital because she fell off the back of the golf cart and smashed her head in. And, you know, she made a full recovery. We're all right. Sorry. Should have said that first. You know, but I got to be there for my two younger brothers and have them both collapse in my arms and hug them and tell them it's going to be all right. And especially my other little brother who was driving the golf cart, who was beating himself up about it and said it was his fault. And I looked at him. I told him it was just God. And, you know, Andy's going to be fine. And that, you know, it's all right. It wasn't your fault. And I was the first person to tell him that because of all the chaos of rushing her there and all this stuff. And that's not me. That's not who I am. If I was still drinking, I'd be in some other state, getting drunk, gotten a message, called, pretended like I was concerned, tell him I was coming home, but would have been too drunk to do it. And beat myself up later about the guilt and remorse I felt for not showing up and continued the vicious cycle. And not today. I don't have to do that kind of stuff today. You know, I get to show up and be reliable and counted on. And that was one of the most beautiful things I've ever had the opportunity of doing. You know, and also to be there for my younger sister, you know, who's beautiful. And she's my little sweet pea. She hates it that I call her that now because she's 12. Oh, my God. Anyways, I totally creep her Facebook page. She hates that, too. Whenever a boy writes on there, I'm right there. I'm like, hey, just stop in and say hi. Love your big brother. You know. You know. So, do we have the time? Because it says 12:28, I'm assuming. Oh, it's right up there. That'd be sweet. Awesome. oh, boy. You know, so, you know, those promises have really come true in my life. It's nothing than that has to do with me. It's because of the people in this room and ultimately God, you know. And I can't tell you how grateful I am because of that. All right, let's see. Run out of things to say here. What else we got? All right, if you're new, grab a sponsor. Grab someone who's got a smile on their face. And, you know, really try to work this program. I'm so happy we're not in the results business, you know, because if we were, I'd be in big trouble because I would beat myself up because I've really tried to, you know, in the beginning, really tried to, you know, get these people to understand how wonderful it is. Like, if I can only switch brains with me, you'd totally understand this program. Like, and they just look at me and I've had it's awesome to see that passed down, you know. Someone else gets it, and then they pass it down, and then a person gets it, and then you start doing it. And, you know, I'm about love and service today, which I never thought I'd be because of this program. You know, and most of you probably know what I'm talking about. And I got 5 minutes, but this one says I only got one. Oh, man. All right. Well, I was told once I started thinking in my head, God is no longer using me, you know. So with that, I'm going to shut up because I feel like I'm a bumbling fool here right now. And thanks for letting me share, guys.